Welcome to The Clever Cookster, your ultimate window into the kitchens of the world's best cooks. I'm your host, Kara Rota. Before we get started, I want to say thanks to this week's sponsor, eMeals. Want to take the stress out of meal planning? Do you ever wish that someone would just hand you a meal plan with shopping lists, recipes, and all? eMeals can help. eMeals makes meal planning simple by sending you weekly menus, shopping lists, and recipes right to your inbox. There are plenty of meal plans to choose from, including kid-friendly, vegetarian, gluten-free, and Mediterranean. Go ahead, check it out today. For Clever Cookster listeners, you can get a 2-week free trial if you go to quickanddirtytips.com/clevermeals. That's a 2-week free trial of delicious, dietitian-vetted meal plans at quickanddirtytips.com/clevermeals. We're so lucky to have as our guest today Mimi Sheraton, a groundbreaking food journalist, the former restaurant critic for multiple publications, including the New York Times, and author of 16 books, including her most recent, 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, A Food Lover's Life List. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Kara. I'm really delighted.
So let's talk first about this new book. It's really an epic undertaking to pinpoint the dishes and tastes from around the world that you think are unmissable. What was the process like to put that together?
Well, when it was once decided that I would really do 1,000 foods to eat before you die, I sat down and began making a list, and I kept going and going and going and came close to 2,000 just out of memory. But the first two I put down were frozen Milky Way and caviar, and that seemed to define the range in the book. Very mundane, very simple, very inexpensive, contrasted to the exotic from far away and very expensive. And then, of course, I had to make choices and switches in order to have a global distribution. I could have had 1,000 things to eat from France or Italy, but I wanted to have some dishes I know from the Silk Road and from sub-Saharan Africa and Middle Europe. And so some things bit the dust to make room for others.
And then another of your books, The German Cookbook, was recently released in its celebratory 50th anniversary edition, which is pretty remarkable. What do you think it is that makes some cookbooks really withstand the test of time and be useful to home cooks for decades or even longer?
I think perhaps they have to be very solid, very basic, and have, in the case of The German Cookbook, I guess, an appeal to second, third, and fourth generation people who want to know how to cook the food of their forebears. I really think that was the strength of The German Cookbook. On the other hand, cookbooks such as Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking, it's so fundamental, it's so sound, it's not a gimmick, that it has indeed stood the test of time.
I think there is something that's happening and that's been happening for a while that might be relevant to The German Cookbook, which is that people of a younger generation are really interested in going back and learning the cuisine of their ancestors that might not have been so common to cook in American households a generation or two ago.
I think that's right. I think the second and third generations go back to those roots, whereas the first generation born here is a little anxious to be separated from it. Their parents probably speak with an accent. They probably do some things that are very old-fashioned at home. That embarrasses the younger people. And then suddenly they begin wondering. Also, in the case of German cooking, just now, in the last 5, 7, 10 years, has been reshaped a great deal and is becoming more stylish around the country. I think Kurt Guttenbrunner in New York with Walze and Blauer Gans and Café Sabarsky. I think Hans Rockenwagner in the area of Santa Monica, Peter Grunauer in Kansas City. They are reviving really fine Austrian and German cooking. And then there's a lot in German cooking that lends itself to gregarious, not too expensive eating in the form of beer halls with Wurst, and so it's beginning to have a new relevance.
You reviewed restaurants for so many years, not only for the New York Times, but for The Village Voice, Time, and other publications. And I think really the way that people learn about and judge new restaurants has changed tremendously, obviously largely through technology and social media. How do you think those changes impact the industry, for better or worse?
Well, they have a great impact. The online reviews that are consumer-based have, in my opinion, far too much power because I don't really trust the sources. I don't know if it's a friend of the owner or friends of the owner who just goes on, you know, Yelp, or I've even felt that way about Zagat through the years. It's handy for phone numbers and addresses, but I don't put too much stock in the ratings. But I do think the people who really are food-minded and are really serious tend to trust mostly their local critics, which I think is the better way to go. In 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, where we wanted sources or backup for anything that we were recommending, I did not go to any consumer-based surveys or ratings.
What are some of the most memorable meals you've eaten lately, either at restaurants or not?
Well, I just had very good Manhattan clam chowder and a fried fish sandwich at Eisenberg, but that may surprise people. I had a wonderful meal a few weeks ago at a new restaurant called Vic's, V-I-C apostrophe S, which replaced an old favorite called Five Points, under the same management but a different chef and menu, and it's sort of stylized Italian and was really excellent. I've had wonderful meals at the new Elan, which was David Waltuck, who had Chanterelle for so many years. A great little seafood place that opened in my neighborhood, which is the West Village in New York, is called The Clam. And there are many clam dishes, but many other shellfish and fish dishes that are exceptional in a very charming setting. I am not too happy about restaurants now that are too dark, too noisy, and too cramped, which seems to be a formula for success. But all of those I mentioned are comfortable as well as excellent.
What are some things that you cook at home when you have a short amount of time, nothing too special in the fridge that are sort of your go-tos?
Nothing too special in the fridge?
Maybe you always have very special things in your fridge. I don't know.
Always have eggs. I make lots of things out of those. Well, when I was cooking for my family, my husband was Italian-American, and Italian cooking was a lot of what I did. I love it. Our son loved it. But I do some Eastern European Jewish cooking, which is what I grew up with. I'm very fond of Scandinavian and obviously German, which I tended to do in the fall and winter, especially around the holidays. That those foods lend themselves to big buffets and Christmas dinners. And in summer, I have done a lot of Middle Eastern cooking. We have a garden and can cook out. And so doing kebabs and broiled things led to perfecting all sorts of meze and eggplant dishes, which I found in a genuine way traveling through the Middle East. And it certainly is among my favorite cuisines. There's a place near my home in the village called Memme that does that food very well, especially a dish that's taking hold in New York right now and which is an entry in 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, and it's called shakshuka, eggs baked in very pungent tomato sauce. And they do it with strips of toasted pita and a little tahini sesame sauce spooned into it.
I love that idea that seasonality is relevant not just for ingredients, but also that there are different cuisines that sort of make sense at different times of year.
I find that to be true. I don't think I want a big German dinner in July,
right. And
I'm not going to cook out in February.
What are some trends that you see happening among new cookbooks that are particularly exciting?
One of the most interesting is the cooking of the Eastern Mediterranean, which is primarily North Africa, across to Israel, Lebanon, and so on, Egypt, and so on. And it has very much the same ingredients and the same types of dishes as the Western Mediterranean, Spain, Italy, France, even Greece. But there's a very different kind of seasoning. To oversimplify by way of explanation, I think the Western Mediterranean relies more on herbs and the Eastern more on spices. So you get a heavy blanket of complex flavors over your eggplant or your grilled lamb, or whether you're making shakshuka or piperad, which is the same thing, they come out quite differently depending upon the seasoning.
And just to end, I wanted to ask you sort of what advice you would give to food writers starting out in the industry. I think that writing about food is in some ways much more difficult than it looks, especially since so many people are doing it in an informal way that started out sort of with blogging just for their friends. And now is sort of, I think food writing has changed a lot. So what are some things that you think people should keep in mind?
Well, the problem is to be a food writer, you have to be very good at two things. And this always creates a problem when a publication wants to hire a food writer. You have to know what you're talking about. You have to know about food, but you have to write well, because you can know all about food and write in a way that no one will read you, or the other way around. You can be a great writer and you're leading people to terrible stuff, which happens. There's a lot of that both around. So I guess you have to... Studying writing is a difficult thing. I suppose you begin by finding a model and for a little while copying it until you take off on your own. But I would like to say whenever anyone asks me about writing, I say, don't think of it as writing. Think of it as saying something. Don't think of what you want to write. Think of what you want to say and start from that. And then, you know, you have to know how to spell and you have to know grammar and so on. But with luck, you will develop a voice. And that's the most important part of it.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Check out Mimi's latest book, 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, as well as her other 16 books. And thanks again to this week's sponsor, Emails. Don't forget to get your 2-week free trial. That's 2 weeks of delicious meal plans over at quickanddirtytips.com/clevermeals. And join us next time on The Clever Cookster for more tips and tricks from the kitchens of the world's best cooks.